Accession number 18475, Reel 2.
Yes.
Arnold Baldwin, Reel 2.
Right. I have to think.
You were just saying that you could go to the BEF in France to do this work on bases.
That was the... I'll say the lure. I think I felt that I was lured into it on the grounds of very little square bashing there. First-class trade pay, and I needed good money because I was still supportive of my mother. It meant that I'd have to make out a family allowance claim for her from the army. And, of course, the higher rate of pay I got, the more of it would come back to me. And also, the idea of going to France, I was very keen on that. I don't mean that I simply thought, well, the army will pay for my tourism. It wasn't quite like that, but I was fascinated by France anyway. So I joined this company. It was a local one in Croydon. A well-known company now. They grew very big and very wealthy, I might add, as a result of World War II. They were not highly regarded before the war, but they were one of the biggest companies after the war, and that was Waits of Norbury. Now, most of the men that I joined up with that formed this company were Croydon workers in Waits's firm. I had never worked for them. In fact, I lost no time in expressing my contempt for them to some of the officers. I worked in joinery shops for the people who were top of the trade, as it were. And Waits were what was known in those days as field rangers, just people who knocked up cheap housing, speculative builders, really. So I didn't think highly of Waits, but I thought it would serve my purpose. Well, we moved from Chatham. We did have just about 3 weeks in Chatham, as they'd promised, so the first part of the promises came true. But then we moved to Potter's Bar, North London, somewhere up the north of London. And we spent weeks there doing nothing really but simply going on route marches and things like this. And then the Germans attacked in Norway. And we were entrained for Glasgow, the King George V dock in Glasgow, presumably to go and oppose the Germans in Norway. Well, that didn't come off. We went aboard a ship, two ships in fact. First one was the Lancastria, which was subsequently sunk off Dunkirk.
Saint-Nazaire, actually.
Saint-Nazaire. Oh, you got that right. I haven't. But I remember it was sunk. When we boarded that ship in the dock, it was victualled up. It was still a liner in conducting its business. And it was victualled up, staffed and everything ready for a trip to New York. But they held it in the dock. The government held it and then just made a transport of it. Unfortunately, we didn't benefit much from that because... it was all beautiful accommodation. There we were in bunks, lovely white counterpanes on the bunks and this sort of thing. But we spent about half the night on it, I think, and then we were slung off again. And the next time we went back, we went to Gale's Camp and we hung about there while the those people who had been sent to Norway. Incidentally, it's just as well we didn't go, because not one of us had fired a round. We'd never used our rifles, we just carried them about. So it was a bit of a relief that we didn't get pushed in there, actually. It would have been stupid. When that collapsed, we came back down to Potter's Bar. I hung about there for a time. And then again we entrained for Glasgow. And this time, we were on a, I think it would be a P&O liner. It was certainly on the Australian run. I think it was the Oronze, it was called. And we found ourselves out at sea after two or three nights hanging about on this ship. We had an escort when we first left of a cruiser and two destroyers, which we were very grateful to see conducting us somewhere. Then the word came round that we were going to Iceland. And eventually, of course, that's where we went. And we spent 16 months as a company in Iceland from about July 1940 to November 41, building hutting sites for the other troops there, the infantry, artillery, ACAC people and so on that were stationed there or going to be stationed there. We were also engaged on building the aerodrome at Reykjavik, which was afterwards taken over by the Americans. And we spent, as I say, something like 16 months there. Well, from the moment I joined the army, I still carried out political propaganda, as I'd done at work. And I was well known as a Red, and a strange thing happened one day. We were in the summertime in Iceland, because of the very nearly 24 hours of daylight, we were working two shifts. Half of us did a shift of, I can't recall the exact hours we did now, but we split most of the daylight hours in two. And half of us would be up on the aerodrome, which we were then engaged on. The others would be resting in the billet. And I came back from the job one day to find there was a lot of blasting going on, because it was just a lava bed, but where we were constructing the aerodrome, but some of them were quite large boulders which had to be blown up all the time. You couldn't move them. And so consequently there was blasting going on all the time, and there were red flags put out for danger where the blasting operations were. And when I got back to my billet one day, my bed was decorated with red flags. Well, I was angry at first, you know. I'd no idea why, and I thought some bastard was stirring it up for me. So I said, what the hell's all this? And one of them said to me, well, haven't you heard the news? So I said, no, what news? They said, well, Russia's in the war. I said, what? So he said, yeah. So I said, well, tell me a bit more. I said, they would never join this bloody war. I can't understand that. They said, oh, no, the Germans have attacked them. So I said, but the stupid bastards, I remember saying this quite clearly to the fellas in my hut. I said, that bloody Hitler must be mad. I said, he'd got the war sewn up. It was bugger all we could do. Okay, I hope my language
please go ahead.
Doesn't matter, but yeah. I mean, I'm talking as we were. There was no way he was going to lose the war up until that point. He'd got it all sewn up. But I said, there's no way now he's going to win it. I said, he's lost the war from now on. And these blokes said, oh, the usual thing that, the usual propaganda that was going on at the time was that Hitler was going to go through Russia like a knife through butter was the conventional term, and the war there would be over in next to no time. I said, don't believe it. I said that he's lost it now. He's done it. He's blown it. And in November, we returned, November 41, we returned to England.
How did you get on with the Icelanders?
They had a communist party. That's quite interesting. They were not over-friendly because they just didn't want any part of the war at all. They were very independently minded people. And they were proud of their Nordic traditions. They're very much Nordic. This led some people, quite a few, to think because they were unfriendly and because they were proud of their Nordic traditions that they were friendly to Germany, but there might have been a small number of them who were, but they kept a very low profile in that case. I've got one or two Icelandic books on the shelf there somewhere. They had a left book club. Of course, you know all about the left book club here, which I was a member. They had one in Iceland, although it wasn't quite as left, because the very first book they put out was a translation of Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms, which wasn't exactly left-wing propaganda, although it's a book that I greatly admired, was very, very fond of. Where we worked, we had Icelanders as labourers. We were more or less in charge of building construction. We would supervise the work and so on. A lot of it was carried out by Icelanders who were quite pleased to have the work, actually, I think, but not very pleased to be invaded. So relations were a bit difficult, unless if you were the type of person, and I'm afraid that many British soldiers are like that. They would sit in their hut. They wouldn't go out and try and contact anyone or go round and have a look or even climb a ruddy mountain, and there were enough of them handy. I had friends who would do that. We would go and wander up a mountain. The only trouble was when we got to one, the next one was higher. And this is always very frustrating. But most of them would sit in the hut. They were all lads. I still see some of them now from Croydon. They came from a very rough area that was known as the Banghole. So you can imagine that they were a pretty rough crew. They would sit in the hut of and say, oh, blimey, Saturday night, eh? Saturday night at home. God, blimey. This ain't any bloody good, is it? You know, this sort of pathetic patter, it used to get up my nose. Anyway, where was I?
You were talking about what the Icelanders thought of the Allied forces.
Ah, yes. They had this left-wing group, and also the Icelanders had a lot of time on their hands for education. If they wanted to what's the word for when people take courses from universities without actually attending the university?
Extramural.
Something like that, yes. They did this quite a bit. One of the fellows that we had as a translator, he would tell the Icelandic Labour what we wanted done and so on, was a very amusing man. He spoke seven languages. his English was very good, very good. But his use of certain words was applied straight from the dictionary. For instance, if you were putting in the foundations for some huts or something, he referred to them as the fundamentals. So, you know, and we would explain these things to him. And of course, he loved our English swearing. He loved the dirty jokes we told and the expressions we had and things like that. He was learning all this very fast, and he would guffaw with laughter. He was quite a nice fellow. And we also, they used Icelandic lorries and so on for transporting materials, building materials as well. And we got to know that some of these drivers, and on one occasion, I've got quite a lot of Icelandic photos somewhere. On one occasion, four of us hired a chap who had his car, hired it as a taxi. They, all their vehicles there were American. Buicks, big old Buicks and cars like that. They had the old Model T Ford lorries with a flat back, no sides, although they were getting Ford V8s in just before the war, which, and the Ford V8 was all the rage in those days. I think so, even in one of Crosby's songs, wasn't it? Ride the range in a Ford V8. So they did have, but it was all American stuff. And this fellow who worked in a gang, he had a big Buick, quite a big Buick, and we talked to him about having a day off and would he drive us round, a few of us. So about four or five of us, we clubbed together, and he took us for a drive in southern, this is the southern part of Iceland, in the vicinity of Reykjavik. We went to various places that are now on the tourists' itinerary now, I suppose, like the Great Geyser. They prided themselves very much in the fact that they were about the earliest democracy that you could find, because they'd gone there to escape from one of the kings of Norway, who was very much a dictator as much as a king, and they'd set up their own parliament in a small valley, open air of course, had no buildings then. Thingvetla was the name of the place, I think, and they're very proud of this tradition of theirs, that they could meet and discuss and take decisions and so on, and they didn't like any form of oppression, but nobody likes that. But they didn't like being governed, as it were. They were an independently minded people. And
did you get in contact with the left-wing movement in Reykjavik?
Yes. This is interesting. I soon managed to find one or two people in different units to mine who were communists. And one was in another regiment. I can't remember the regiment now. But I met him in Reykjavik. I knew his sister in England, oddly enough. She was political, of course. He was a Scotsman. And he'd been educated in St. Andrew's University. Just St. Andrew's University, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And do you know he learned Icelandic just like that? Amazing what the academic education can do for a man, because it took him no... Here he was a communist, and he was the British government's official translator in any negotiations between Icelanders and the occupying forces that went to law. he went to the court and...
what was his name?
There you got me again.
Don't worry.
I'm sorry. You know, this is a long, long time ago. I'm still talking not about 1945 when the war ended. I'm talking about in the early days of the war, around about 1940. That's long enough ago.
And did he put you in contact with the Icelandic communists?
Yes, he did. The government, the army, rather, very quickly rounded up, when they got there, they rounded up the communists, the well-known communists in Iceland, and they deported them and imprisoned them in Brixton. This was well known in Iceland that their leadership of their party was in Brixton jail. Along, of course, with Nazi sympathisers and people like that. It was most peculiar business. Well, when the Hitler launched his attack on the Soviet Union, the Icelandic Communist Party, which had been opposing the British occupation on the grounds of neutrality, not sympathy with the Nazis, but simply on neutrality. When Hitler attacked the Soviet Union, of course, they swung round and changed their position. A lot of this went on, as you're no doubt aware. And they released the imprisoned Icelandic communists from Brixton, and they came back to Iceland. And a big meeting was held. And this translator chap, he was a Lance Corporal, if I remember right, but I can't remember his regiment or his name.
Did you attend the meeting?
Yes. I met him and he said there's going to be a big meeting to welcome back these fellows from Brixton. He said, do you want to come to it? So I said, oh, yeah, sure. As I say, I got established friendly relations, not on a political basis at all, but among Icelanders I could speak to. And I said, yes, I'm only too pleased to come. So he and I don't know if there was anybody else with us or not, but of course we were in our uniforms. And this hall was quite packed, and actually it was a whopping great fish drying shed. I don't think they had holes as such then, but it had a platform at one end anyway. And when we walked in and stood at the back, there was considerable murmuring among some of the Icelanders who were packed at the back there to see us there in uniforms. And somebody who knew this fellow I was with quieted him down. He said, it's all right, they're friends, and don't bother. So we were there when these chaps described their experiences in Brixton and so on. And from there on, of course, the war had taken a different course, hadn't it?
What kind of response did you get for your left-wing propaganda amongst your comrades in the army?
Not a lot. Strange thing was that years later, I can come to that later, I was hitchhiking through the East End, going down from Essex, down into town for a day out. And a military lorry passed me, and chaps were all in the back. It was a three-tonner. Open at back, of course, and I thought, blimey, they're the boys from my old mob there, the ones I'd known in Iceland and so on. So they stopped the lorry and hauled me on board, and one fella straight away said to me, you were right, weren't you? This would be 43, 43 or 4, I'm not quite sure now. I could check if I check my dates, but B 43 or 4. And one of the fellows said to me straight away, he said, "You were right." I said, "What do you mean I was right? You said that Hitler had lost the bloody war. And you proved to be right, mate, because they were then on the retreat." So I said, "Yeah, well, I knew it. It was obvious to me." But in general, I don't think I made much impact at all. Much more than you do at workplaces or wherever you are conducting any propaganda. It's a long, hard slog with very little signs of it bearing fruit.
Now, you were telling me about coming back from Iceland in 41. What happened to you then?
We returned, I think, in November 41, and we were stationed at Tame in Oxfordshire. And immediately we were put to work again, building a big new ordnance depot at Bicester, again in Oxfordshire, and a few miles from Tame. So it was transport by lorry each day and so on to work there. Well, one of the things that I saw then and had never seen before was to see some aircraft pottering around all the time. Seemed that one was towing another one and they were going round. It came from, I think, Kidlington, which was quite nearby, and was one of the early glider training schools. Anyway, I'd never seen anything quite like this before, and I was, at that stage, the war had taken such a turn to what it had been when I joined in January in 40, when I joined the army. I'd no real interest in it as a war, because there wasn't one. Well, I was interested in it now, and I wanted to get out of this, what was really a non-combatant unit, into something a bit more active. As a communist, I naturally wanted to do a bit of fighting. And I was curious about these things flying around. We hadn't been back very many weeks before a notice appeared on the orders to say volunteers were required in the first place for training as parachutists. So you should submit your application to your CO. So I applied to my CO. They stipulated that applicants must be trained soldiers. Well, by that they meant infantrymen, I assume. Anyway, I put my name forward and went to see the CO, whom I hadn't got a great deal of respect for anyway. And he said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I can't put you forward." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Well, you're not a trained soldier."